This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. A tourist describes the west end of Maui where wildfires rage.
Yeah, it was scary seeing driving through. You couldn't see any structures of the buildings. It gone, looked like a bomb went off. All the cars with full gas tanks that reached the fire, they were exploded.
Hawaii's governor says at least 53 people have died. CBS's Jonathan Vigliotti is on Maui.
People getting in helicopters used for tours to bring food into places and to get evacuees out. The military is also on the scene, assisting with the search and rescue on the ground. Sources tell us that there are hundreds of homes and all of the wreckage that has yet to be sifted through. So it really is a race against the clock.
President Biden has signed a disaster declaration.
Our prayers with the people of Hawaii, but not just our prayers. Every asset we have will be available to them. And they've seen their homes, their business destroyed, and some have lost loved ones. And it's not over yet.
Five Americans are no longer in prison in Iran. CBS News has learned the move comes in an exchange with Washington for access to billions of dollars frozen in South Korea. CBS's Margaret Brennan says the Americans include
Imad Sharghi, an American businessman who has been held since 2018. Murad Tabaz, also held since 2018. He's an Iranian-American environmentalist. Siamak Namazi, 51 years old, held for 8 years, just released to house arrest.
9 of the 16 Michigan Republican Party electors accused of filing false election documents on behalf of former President Trump plead not guilty to felony charges. WWJ's John Hewitt.
The arraignments via Zoom were in response to felony charges that the electors falsely claimed former President Trump won Michigan's 2020 presidential election. In this exchange, attorney Dave Coleman, representing defendant William Choate of Cement City, asks Judge Kristen Simmons for a delay in the scheduled probable cause conference and preliminary exam.
There's over 100 police reports. There's voluminous discovery I have to go through.
I recognize that I've done at least one of the co-defendant's cases already, and they have the same issue there. Your client needs to appear for all the court dates.
John Hewitt for CBS News, Detroit.
The Supreme Court temporarily blocks a nationwide settlement with OxyContin maker Purdue Pharma.
The settlement was reached last year with state and local governments, but the Biden administration had asked the high court to block it. It said members of the Sackler family shouldn't be released from legal liability. The justices blocked the agreement for now, but scheduled arguments over whether to allow it to proceed. They said they want to decide whether bankruptcy law allows for a blanket shield for the family from lawsuits filed by all opioid victims. Christopher Cruz, CBS News, Washington.
If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Their end-to-end hiring system helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates all in the same place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
I'm James.
Thanks for listening to your local Civic Media radio station. Learn more on our website, civicmedia.us.
For WCFW and the Tap FM, I'm Jimmy Cuska. Here's what you need to know in the Chippewa Valley. Hearings this week are over in the Lily Peters homicide case in Chippewa County, and now a judge will decide next year whether the lone suspect, a 15-year-old boy, will be tried as an adult or if the case will go to juvenile court. The teenager is charged with murdering 10-year-old Lily Peters last year and leaving her body in the woods near her Chippewa Falls home. Testimony in reverse waiver hearings this week focused on the boy's mental health and treatment options available in state prison. If the boy is convicted of homicide as an adult, he would serve a mandatory life sentence in prison. If the case moves to juvenile court, he would be under supervision for the next 10 years. Judge Stephen Gibbs will decide in January where the case will go. Two homicide suspects in Eau Claire County are being tried separately. Brandon Gaston and Tracy Clark are both accused of killing an Altoona man and hiding his corpse. The body of 79-year-old Dennis Shoddy was found decapitated in the Rock River in Rockford, Illinois last April. Gaston will appear in court later this month. Clark's next court appearance is in October. For Civic Media News, I'm Jimmy Cuska.
Did you know the Wisconsin State Fair is 172 years old? It still celebrates the industries important to our state's history, like agriculture. But every year, new attractions and items are added. This year, there's more than 100 new foods to try. So what do you think topped the culinary list last year? Flamin' hot Cheetos, chicken on a stick, deep-fried old-fashioned, or pino pretzel popper brat? The answer's coming up. The Wisconsin State Fair didn't start in its current home of West Alice. The first was in Janesville along the Rock River, then moved to different locations the next 40 years. The original cream puff has been around almost as long. Close to 400,000 are gobbled up every year. So which food was number one last year? It was the Pino Pretzel Popper brat. It came out on top. The State Fair is a true slice of Wisconsin, and it runs through August 13th. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
It's summertime in Wisconsin, and whatever the weather, it will impact you and your plans.
Should I water the garden? Will our event be rained out? Count on your local Civic Media radio station for in-depth details and the most up-to-date forecast.
Temperatures are rising into the mid and upper 70s under sunny skies.
It's your weather and more for your part of Wisconsin.
On your local Civic Media radio station and streaming on the Civic Media app. Pursuing the truth wherever it may lead. The Todd Albaugh Show, weekday afternoons from 1 till 3. Join the conversation. Get involved. The Todd Albaugh Show on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. It's What's on Tap for the Chippewa Valley. 93.5 The Tap.
He hasn't gone down to the border like Tim Scott to stare at the water and pretend he gives a damn. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So some interesting news on the inflation rate. Things not looking so bad. Now, I know, again, everyone's complaining gas and groceries are still up, but I still argue the gas prices have a lot to do with the fact that, oh, I don't know, the oil companies are just going, no, we like prices where they are. We're making nice profits. We don't have to drill anymore. And it's good PR. We get to beat up Biden with it, and because yeah, they'll blame him. Yeah, I think that's sadly where we're going. But consumer price index rose 3.2% from a year ago in July. Evidently, they're claiming inflation has lost a bit of its grip on the U.S. economy. And here to share some thoughts on what this means, if this is going to hold going forward, or anything else we can dream up. I've asked our good friend Morris Pearl to come talk with us. Morris is the chairman of the Patriotic Millionaires, patrioticmillionaires.org, the website. Morris, thanks for taking time for us.
Great to be in your show, Rick. Thank you.
So what's this mean? I look at these numbers, and you know, some numbers make my head spin. You know, people are still struggling to make ends meet. Does this mean anything to them right now?
Well, it means inflation went up when we had a COVID-19 disruption to the entire economy and disruption to all kinds of things. And inflation went back down again as the disruption is going away. It's not completely gone, but I think for the most part, 3.2% is not so bad. You know, there was a time when it was a crisis in the 1970s and 80s when it was like 12 and 15%. So I think we're not doing that badly. I think people at the low wage areas are actually catching up quite a bit. For some people, their wages have gone up more than their costs have gone up, particularly the people at the lowest, earning the lowest wages. You know, around here, you're not going to find any jobs for less than $20-$25 an hour, even at fast food places. So things have changed a lot. People are demanding higher wages. People are joining unions. People are going on strike, and people are not putting up with starvation wages anymore. So if you want to be in business, you have to pay people enough to get by. And that's what the workers are telling you. And frankly, that's what's making America, if not great again, but pretty good again.
Yeah, let me ask you this, because, you know, we just had a caller say that there are all these jobs out there, Morris. You know, there are tons of jobs nobody wants. Nobody wants to work anymore. How do you view that narrative?
Well, people do want to work if they can make $25 and $30 an hour and have enough earnings to support their family. Then they want to work. People don't want to work if they're going to be the working poor and indigent anyway. That's the people that don't want to work. companies that are providing living wages for their workers are hiring workers. Companies that have this idea that people should work for us and get food stamps too, those companies are having trouble finding workers. Yeah, and they should.
You know, that phrase I grew up believing in, you work hard, play by the rules, you get ahead. The get ahead part of it's the really important part of it.
And that's frankly what the patriotic millionaires are working on, is the fact that so many people have figured out they're not getting ahead. And not everyone got ahead in, you know, the previous generations too. It was okay for like white guys whose families had money and lived in the suburbs. It was not so okay for, you know, black guys who lived in the South and wanted to move to the North. We were just looking at what President Biden did with the Davis-Bacon rules about prevailing wages. Those were originally put in place in the 1930s because black people were starting to move to New York. And they didn't like having black people showing up on Long Island. And so that's why they put the prevailing wage rules into place, so they wouldn't have to put up with these laborers from the South coming and building their post office in Hicksville.
And they wanted to ensure that, you know, you had a local trade. And you're right, there's racist themes to a lot of this, but also the bottom didn't fall out of the labor force.
No, not at all. And here we have a situation where people who want to get good jobs and support their families, a lot of them can now. The unemployment rate is down below where it was just a few years ago, and people are getting back to work. Some are working remotely. A lot of jobs you can't work remotely, that you have to do something in person. But for jobs that are paying living wages, there are people to do those jobs.
No, it seems simple. It seems like, you know, I seem to remember this stuff, you know, from my college economics courses, that if there's a high demand for something, the prices are up. If there's no demand, the prices are down. If there is as much hiring demand out there, the wages should be coming up. That's how it's supposed to work, right?
And that's how it is working now. And some of that is because workers are having more rights to organize than they did under the previous administration. We now have a National Labor Relations Board that is actually encouraging labor relations.
Well, actually doing what the original intent of the Labor Relations Act was, and that is to encourage people to join and form unions, not just be a bystander. And that's the one thing that I love about the Biden administration, is they're going back to the original intent. If we're going to be original intentists, let's talk about the original intent of the Fair Labor Standards Act and the National Labor Relations Act and all of those things that helped build the middle class that my grandparents' generation fought for.
You know, I was, you know, a little bit nervous after the 2020 election, but I think we're seeing President Biden put into place people who actually believe what you were just saying, Rick. And it's all these little things, people like Julie Sue and, you know,
Jennifer Abutio.
Yeah. The vice president doesn't want to use the word acting, but essentially the labor secretary. And they're actually trying to do their jobs the way they're supposed to.
And this is why, you know, I tweet out as often as I can when I see something like the Davis-Bacon thing that he did the other day, or any of these things that I think are helpful to working people. This is why I voted for him, because he's going to put people in place who are going to use their authority to make working people's lives better. And I think this administration is, when we look back at this in 10 years, I think we're going to look back to this as a very transformative period of time. And anytime I can see Larry Summers lose his mind, I'm pretty happy with that.
Yeah, it's not that, you know, if you want someone who's going to run around the country sort of being a big bully and yelling at people and threatening them, you got the wrong guy. But if you want someone who's actually going to change the rules under which our economy operates, Joseph Biden is your guy.
Yeah. You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Morris Pearl. Morris, the chairman of the Patriotic Millionaires. PatrioticMillionaires.org is the website. You know, take a look at the work that they do. I got to get your thought. I got to ask this. ProPublica or NPR ProPublica came out with some pieces today on Clarence Thomas and his vacationing habits. I got to ask you, you're probably one of the wealthiest guys I know. How many Supreme Court justices have you paid for vacation for?
Paid for vacation? None. Zero.
Probably because you don't have any cases in front of the Supreme Court. Because here's the weird thing. No. I see all of these trips that Clarence Thomas has taken on someone else's dime. And I got to go. I got to say, this guy's taken, you know, more trips while in the Supreme Court than most people take in families, in generations of families' lives. It's quite remarkable.
And he does earn like $280,000 a year. It's not like he's a pauper either. And he's just a very bitter kind of guy. He went to school. He graduated from law school in the 1970s. And he couldn't get he applied for jobs. No one would hire him because they thought that he was only there because of affirmative action. He could not get a job. Finally got a job working for Danforth, the Attorney General of Missouri, who taught him to be a conservative and fight against these programs. And he's been like bitter ever since. And it's just a sad situation that he feels this entitlement to get what all these rich white guys had that he never was able to quite get, not due to his faults, but due to whatever. He was never quite in the right place at the right time until he was appointed by Reagan to the Supreme Court. Then he was in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, but here's the thing, and this is where my argument was at the beginning. Look, I'm sure the justices of the past were just as well taken care of. I'm sure that this stuff has happened in the past. It's the difference being that it seemed that institutions used to work a little bit better.
I don't think there's been anyone as bad as Clarence Thomas, at least in my lifetime. And that goes back a ways.
Maybe not Scalia.
I mean, I disagree with Scalia about a lot of things, but I don't think he's I don't think he's on the take.
Do you buy the argument that Thomas makes that they're just friends? These are just friends of his who are doing nice things for him.
Well, the thing that I learned when I got involved in politics in 2004, for a few tens of thousands of dollars, you can become anybody's best friend.
Yeah.
Maybe with inflation, it's a few hundred thousand dollars now, but when I started donating to political things in the 2004 season, I suddenly had a lot of best friends.
Yeah, I can see how that works. As I always say, what the right has figured out, they figured out how to herd cats. And there's only one way that you herd cats, and that's you put the food dish on the floor and let all the cats come to it. I assume that having a checkbook does kind of the same thing.
And there are people, frankly, I think most people are basically honest and good people, but not everyone.
Yeah. So what do we do with a Clarence Thomas? I know there was a big to do today of, everyone saying he's going to resign. He has to resign. He's not going to. What should happen here in a functional democracy? What should happen here?
Well, what should happen is, impeachment by the House and removal by the Senate. It's happened, 5 or 10 times in the past. The House has impeached, the Senate has removed federal judges. Never a Supreme Court justice before, but it's the first time for everything. But that's the only mechanism, or unless somebody wants to convince him to resign.
Yeah. Don't see that happening.
If he actually committed a crime, he could be tried and put into prison. But no one's, these things are illegal, but I have trouble seeing the FBI investigating it.
No, there's going to be nothing here other than it's just bad for the court. It's bad for institutions. And the sad reality is all the things that I grew up believing in seem to be struggling in this moment, which means we got a lot of work to do. So last line of questioning I've got for you, given the place that we're in, the economy seems to be tooling along in the right direction, but we've got some political problems. What should we be doing as voters, as workers, as citizens? Any thoughts, any direction?
I think we should be voting for people that are supporting policies that will help people, that will help all the people, not helping the rich get richer, but helping regular people get by. I think that's what we need. We have a country, unfortunately, where people think that the whole thing is rigged. I think the argument from the previous president essentially is that, well, everybody's dishonest. I'm just more open about it than most people. And frankly, a lot of people believe it.
Yeah.
And frankly, there are a lot of dishonest people in the high levels of government here and there, like we've seen with Clarence Thomas. And I think it's just, we've sort of lost that idea from years ago that somebody got involved in government because they actually wanted to help administer the country. And now people get involved in government because they think it's a good career way to, you know, make money as opposed to being a hedge fund manager or something.
A way to get attention, way to get that gig on Fox News. Yeah, I think you're spot on. It comes back to good, decent, honest people running for office, voting for people who want to make change in a positive way. I think all good stuff. Morris, yeah. As always, I appreciate your thoughts, your input, and your insight. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick. Great to be in your show.
Again, our good friend Morris Pearl. Make sure you check out their website, patrioticmillionaires.org. We'll get links out on social media. Back with your thoughts, 1-866-416-RICK, 1-866-416-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
It's interesting how that Morris brought up prevailing wage. And look, he's not wrong. Davis and Bacon, both Republicans. And again, this is another one of those scenarios where you go, each side has their reasons. Each side has, it's like you think of the deregulation of the 70s. You had Carter and Kennedy thinking, hey, this is going to make, you know, a little bit better competition, bring wages, in line, and we're going to get, better prices, it's going to be good. It's going to be good for consumers. Workers won't take it on the chin too badly because they got unions, and they're going to be good. And Republicans knew what it was going to be. You know, we're going to strangle those unions. We're going to undercut the heck out of them and just destroy the whole industry so that we can consolidate and control it. They knew what they were doing, and they did it well. And the same thing here. I mean, you had people who, you've got to keep those people in line. That doesn't mean the policy isn't helpful for everyone. And in this moment where there are more minorities in the building trades than there have ever been, more women in the building trades, and the future is going to be much more diverse, much more integrated, ensuring that these jobs pay a living wage and you can support a family on, kind of important. Now, what's interesting, I get an email from Terry in Santa Fe, who writes me, I'm all for unions and prevailing wages. Good for you, Terry. But here's the but. Not just with government-funded jobs. Understand, where government dollars go into, that's really the only power and control you have. Terry writes, we also need policies that address both union and salaried wages at multinational corporations. Example, several years ago, I interviewed for a production management position at a wood products plant in Michigan. Weyerhaeuser had closed its 30-year-old factory, and Arauco, a Chilean conglomerate, replaced it. The salary attached to the job was 2/3 of what it should have been, so I suspect that the hourly folks
also probably took a pay cut. The bigger picture is the U.S. corporations have been closing unprofitable plants since the 80s, as you know, and moving overseas. I disagree with the unprofitable parts, Terry. Now, the reverse is happening. Overseas employers are stepping into the vacuum and offering lower wage jobs to people desperate enough to take them. It's perverse. The CEOs don't take pay cuts. I support Biden's efforts to promote U.S. job creation. I just hope that we don't have to settle for international overlords, or that companies like Rivian don't get away with hiring foreign workers to avoid paying living wages that our middle class needs. I agree. You know, I agree that there are things we should be doing, and this is why strong labor laws are important. We cannot, as a matter of government force, these you know, big companies, these multinationals, to pay any type of other than a minimum wage. But if you've got strong labor unions, they can sit down and negotiate. They can sit down and demand, kind of like UPS just did, the Teamsters did with UPS. And as was pointed out by Axios today, in the week following the agreement between the Teamsters and UPS, the site Indeed saw a 50% increase in the job searches with UPS or United Parcel Service in the search line, because people are going, hey, those are good jobs. When you get a package car job where you can make between 100 and 150 grand a year, people want those jobs. When you can become a feeder driver, make over 100 grand a year and be home most nights, sign me up. And you know who never has a problem getting people to work for them? Yeah, UPS. Because during the pandemic, they didn't struggle. Because what they did is, we need more people, pay them more money. And people came. Probably something that, I don't know. You know, the other employers could possibly look at. Now me, on the prevailing wage front, I'm a huge supporter of it. If we're going to use our tax dollars to invest in something, a school, a road, a bridge, whatever, I don't mind paying a couple of pennies more for it, even though the truth of the matter is when you use prevailing wage and project labor agreements, generally projects come in on time and under budget because you've got skilled people doing those jobs. The difference between, you know, I got this cheap guy, gonna, you know, he's got a hammer. He's got a hammer. The difference between paying him and someone who actually knows how to swing the hammer is huge. You know, when I want someone to do work in my home, I'm looking for a union electrician if I can get one. I'm looking for a union pipe fitter if I need something done. A union plumber. Because I know that they're going to come in, they're going to do the job quickly. They're well-trained, well-skilled, and things are going to get done. As opposed to, there have been times where we've brought folks in and it's been a struggle. And now magnify that on the size of a project, say like, I don't know, a giant bridge spanning over a giant body of water. You know, think of the Hudson River and the Tappan Zee Bridge. You know, think of the you know, Oakland Bay Bridge there in just outside of San Francisco. And you think of the tail of those two bridges. One was done with prevailing wage and a project labor agreement, and one, well, not so much. One was done on time, under budget. The Tappan Zee was completed early, under budget. The Bay Bridge, I'm told, is never, ever going to be complete because of the shoddy workmanship that was done and the poor product that they used. Because, hey, we needed Chinese steel. Got to go for the cheap stuff. And it's that thing my grandmother always said, you know, you get what you pay for. And it's not that hard to figure out. The cheapest bid isn't always the best one. And my view is, if we're using taxpayer money, shouldn't it benefit the community in more ways than just getting us the thing that we need? Yeah, we need the road, the bridge, the school, the hospital, whatever. We need that. But shouldn't that dollar that we spend, I don't know, stay local, help reverberate through the local economy to make sure that other jobs are created? And there have been numerous studies on this. I could spend hours on the number of studies that I've read on prevailing wage benefiting Main Street. The problem is we've got politicians who it's not about reality. It's about political ideology. It's about punishing their perceived enemies. And this is the weird thing. There used to be pro-labor Republicans. There used to be. There used to be prevailing wage Republicans. I know a couple of the older ones. Not anymore. And this is where, as working people, we got to start putting aside that divisive stuff. Get off the Kool-Aid. Get off the outrage candy. Get off whatever it is that's making us crazy, and get back to, how do we benefit our local communities? How do we make a better society? How do we get the things that we need and use the dollars that we spend in the most efficient way? How about we talk about that? That's not as exciting, is it? No, it's better to be angry. Right back. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1931. That was the day that the Airline Pilots Association affiliated with the American Federation of Labor. The need for pilots to organize became apparent as early as the mid-1920s. The airline industry was new, and pilots often faced dangerous conditions. They were often put under pressure to fly under adverse conditions, especially if they were tasked with delivering the mail. As the Great Depression swept the country, pilots were asked to fly more and more hours for less money. The organization of pilots started off small and in secret, but soon it grew. In 1930, the union got its unofficial start, holding its first convention the following year. David Bank was elected the first president. Bank had served as a flight instructor for the U.S. Army. He then led the Bank Flying Circus, performing air shows all across the Midwest. From there, he went to work for a private airmail service. As union president, Bank established the organization's headquarters in Chicago. Over the years, as plane technology has changed, the union has fought to ensure the continued safety for the pilots. Pilot fatigue, as well as security concerns, especially after the terrorist attacks of 9/11, have also been important issues for the union. Today, the Airline Pilots Association represents more than 50,000 pilots flying for 31 airlines in the United States and Canada. Their mission statement begins with the commitment to, quote, promote and champion all aspects of aviation safety throughout all segments of the aviation community. I'm learning to fly,
bang up wings. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Weather forecasters across the Southwest are having a hard time this summer coming up with descriptive taglines for each day's ever-rising heat. If 105 degrees is hot, what to call 110 and up? Some have quit trying, simply labeling each day again. Luckily, Joe Biden has issued bold new steps to counter the relentless climate change that's causing this extreme killer heat. For example, workers will get hazard alerts telling them that it's hot. Also, a new website will urge everyone to stay hydrated. His aides say this shows that Joe is treating climate change with, quote, the urgency it deserves. Excuse me while I have a political heat stroke. Urgency? The same day Biden launched his pathetic global warming policy, the Republican Supreme Court rubber-stamped his disastrous push for the massively polluting Mountain Valley Pipeline. This 300-mile environmental scar across two states will be like adding 26 more coal-fired power plants to our climate change crisis. Then there's his unconscionable approval this year of Willow, an oil drilling project in the Arctic that will release hundreds of millions of tons of additional greenhouse gas emissions, plus approving and subsidizing dozens of other fossil fuel boondoggles. Worse, Biden has meekly refused to take the genuinely bold step of declaring a climate change emergency, even as he's pushed new laws to remove the people's right to challenge corporate profiteering at the expense of climate sanity. This is Jim Hightower saying, yes, the Republicans are worse, but pointing that out is neither a policy nor good politics. Climate change is not a future problem. It is now. If Biden wonders why his approval rating is a woeful 39%, there it is. People want and need presidential boldness, not a hot weather website.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So yesterday we were talking about this story in Michigan. And, you know, honestly, you thought the whole child labor thing was decided, you know, 80 years ago when we passed the Fair Labor Standards Act and all the labor law that came out of the New Deal. We thought we took kids out of the mines and out of the meat packing plants. Evidently not. Because this story out of Michigan, this 17-year-old kid got his hand chopped off in a meat grinder. And the fine, the whopping fine for the corporation who put this kid in this position was $1,143. That was it. That's the fine. Nobody going to jail. Nothing. No. Nothing harsher. No, not even slap on the imaginary wrist. And I said at the time on social media that, you know, this kid's screwed. And they're like, no, he's going to sue for pain and suffering. Nope, that's not how our law works. So I decided, you know what, we should probably talk to somebody who actually knows. That's why I've asked my good friend Eric Fink to come talk with us. Eric is an associate professor of law at Elon University. Eric, thanks for taking time for us.
Always happy. Always a pleasure, Rick.
So I gotta ask the first question. You got this kid who cut off his hand, 17 years old, shouldn't have been doing it. What's this kid gonna get? I said I looked at the law. I'm not a lawyer, but it said all this kid's entitled to is 215 weeks for losing a hand and medical payments. Is that what this kid's gonna get?
Yeah, workers' comp is all you get if you're injured on the job. It's certainly all you can get from the employer, right? You're not allowed to sue the employer, and it doesn't matter that the employer was violating the law. It doesn't matter that the law, you know, that the kid was underage. The employer, you know, the employer is only liable for the workers' comp, so that's all they got. Now, from reading the story, it doesn't seem like there was anything defective about the meat grinder.
No, right? It worked just fine. It ground up his hand perfectly as it was supposed to.
A meat grinder is an inherently dangerous thing. Now, if this was a case where there was not a proper guard or something defective about the meat grinder, you can sue. This has nothing to do with the fact that he's a minor, an employee who's injured by a defective machine. You can sue the machine manufacturer, right, for their negligence. But that's not the case here. No, so that's what the kid gets. He gets his workers' comp. And as you say, the employer's not paying out of pocket. They paid into the system. So, you know, the employer hit with a whopping, $1,100 fine. That doesn't seem like much of a deterrent against illegally. You know, this kid was working in a meat processing plant, working on a meat grinder. That is specifically illegal for anybody under 18, under federal law. Okay, that's considered a dangerous, a hazardous job, and it's flat out illegal. And I read the story. I noticed that they seem to be really looking for sympathy for the employer. Oh, he would have been 18 in a few weeks, and oh, it's an agricultural county, and they're, you know, people
don't care.
Here. I mean, that's, you know, the law is the law. You know, the law is the law. You know, and it's amazing to me that people recently, this seems to be like in the last year, like really taking steam, people really trying to relax, you know, this whole movement to relax child labor law. And I look at this story and I'm thinking, you know, it's almost like this is trying to like build that sympathy. You know, you'd think that all the sympathy would be with the kid who lost a hand.
Yeah. No, I mean, you're absolutely right. And there's a right-wing movement in this country, a corporate movement, to get kids back into the workforce because, hey, we need cheap labor. And look, when they have their hands attached, they're small enough to get into those small places to be able to do that intricate work, you know, because
right?
Evidently.
Right. And I mean, look, you and I both have kids. I have a kid, he's just 18. He's working in a restaurant now, in a restaurant kitchen for the first time. Well, he's 18 and he's enjoying it. It's fine for kids to work.
Yep.
But there's a good reason for laws like this to restrict, you know, older teens from doing really dangerous stuff. It's dangerous. And anyone who's been a teen, or certainly anyone who's been the parent of a teen, knows, you know, even the smartest ones, they're not always careful. Like they're
kids.
That's how they are. They think they're invincible and they get distracted. You know, it's a really inherently bad idea to have a 17-year-old kid working on a meat grinder.
That seems pretty simple. But look, like you said, look, as a parent, you know, I want my kids to have, you know, summer jobs. I want them to learn the value of a dollar, hard work. You know, we pushed our kids into getting jobs they wanted to. You know, my son's been a lifeguard for a couple of years. You know, those kind of things. I'm all in paper routes like I had as a kid, cutting grass, doing yard work, doing odd jobs. Absolutely. But, you know, competing in the adult world, doing these kind of production jobs, I'm struggling with. And I was watching.
And that's not what this is about. So the people who are pushing this, this is what they say, oh, this is good for the kids, so they'll get experience and blah, blah, blah. That there's tons of jobs that are perfectly appropriate for certainly 15, 16, 17-year-old kids, you know, that are legal for them to do within the limits. And, you know, the hours have to be compatible with schooling and so on. This has nothing to do with the interests of the kids in getting them ready for the labor force. This is, you know, it's the age-old story. Every time, historically, that you get a tight labor market, every time that workers get any kind of leg up in terms of, you know, lower unemployment or bigger demand for labor, and so they're able to command higher wages and so on, the bosses figure out some way, right, to weaken that worker power, and usually it's some way of expanding the labor force. Right. And, you know, so inmate labor has been one thing and child labor, you know, has been another. OK. And that's what this is about now. It's, I don't think it's a coincidence that we're seeing these calls for relaxing child labor laws at a time when labor has had, you know, hardly like a super upper hand, but they've had some greater leverage in the market. And so, of course, we want to get 17-year-old kids to compete for these jobs because they can bid the price down.
Now, the reason I wanted to talk to you about this is because I read the, I was reading through the comments and having conversations with some of the commenters, and there's this sense that no, this is different. He can sue for pain and suffering. He can get all of this other stuff. He'll be fine. And I'm like, no. Yeah. The great compromise of workers' comp is you don't get pain and suffering. You don't get to sue. You get what the law has laid out. And Michigan law says for a hand, you get 215 weeks. That's it. And your medical costs paid and, you know, the lost wages for that period of time. What do you say to people who seem to believe that there are all these laws to protect workers that just don't exist?
Yeah, you know, this is not unique to workers' comp. There's a lot of areas. I've talked about this before on the show. I talk about it all the time. A lot of areas of labor and employment law where people really, you know, just believe, and I don't think it's because people are foolish. I think it's because people have a sense of what would be just and what would be fair and reasonable, and people would like to think that the law is just and fair and reasonable. So people think that workers have all these rights that they just don't have. You know, they simply don't have. Workers' comp is one of the starkest examples. I think any normal person, sense of justice, would say, in a case like this, the kid ought to be able to get something more. But that is simply, the answer is, it's hard for people to accept because it goes so much against people's innate sense of justice, right? That they've learned from childhood, right? But that is the harsh, cruel, cold answer. He gets nothing more than workers' comp.
And you were telling me during the break, you know, about a case in North Carolina that was, you know, even more egregious than this, but that, you know, just laid it out just what you said.
Yeah, it's an old case, but it stands for the point that, you know, this was a small child. He was like a 5 or 6 year old kid. His mom worked in the convenience store in the gas station. Happens to be literally down the block from my, you know, house that I just moved from in North Carolina. He would go with his mom. So when the mom didn't have a babysitter, he would go with the mom while she was working and hang out there. And he would, you know, organize the owner of the store would pay him like a couple of bucks to straighten out the candy bars, and, you know, and the kid was happy, and, you know, nobody really complained about it, even though technically this was illegal child labor. That was probably within the realm of, yeah, nobody's really getting hurt here. But the kid got hurt. He got hurt somewhat badly, and the mom sued for his injuries, assuming that because he was underage and he was not legally employed, that he wouldn't be considered an employee for workers' comp. He wouldn't be covered by workers' comp, and that then he had the right to sue. The company that, you know, the big gas company, I'll leave their name out, but, you know, the owner of the gas station convenience store, they said, no, they asked to throw the suit out because all he gets is workers' comp. And the North Carolina Supreme Court said, and the decision is pretty interesting because the court, you can see that the court, like, are not happy with this because the court, it's that same sense of justice. And they basically say, we understand, like, this seems wrong. This kid was illegally employed, and now the employer is going to get away with it, basically, you know. But that's what the law says. And in North Carolina, now this might vary. I don't know if Michigan literally says it. In North Carolina, the law specifically says that an employee includes someone who's working for pay. It specifically says, even if they are a minor illegally employed, all right? I don't know the history, like, why did someone even think to put that in the law?
Yeah.
But so that's what happened in this case. So the kid, you know, got whatever minimal workers' comp, you know, he was entitled to.
No, it's amazing. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Eric Fink. He's an associate professor of law at Elon University, Elon Law School. You know, also we got into this conversation of, well, it shouldn't be this way. And then got into this grander scheme of, you know, the great compromise of workers' comp that you're giving up your right to your constitutional right to sue in exchange for getting medical care and some monetary amount of money to help you make it through, like the 215 weeks for this kid's hand. And I was reading through the story and the end of it caught my attention. And I want to read it. He goes, The defense attorney Howard Van Duvel, Den Heuvel, said, you know, this guy hired the teen, a high school dropout, as a way to help him. He said the boy was warned to never put his hand inside the grinder. And my argument to this person was, if you don't have workers' comp, you go back to the pre-workers' comp days. That statement alone would probably get this kid absolutely nothing, because the employer would go, we don't have to pay anything. It's his fault. He did it. He did wrong. We've got no liability, no culpability here. He's SOL. That was pre-workers comp, right?
Yeah. In fact, the rule, part of the background to why we got workers comp, is that the traditional rule was you couldn't sue. An employer was not liable for negligence to an employee. Like, even if it was the employer's negligence, it was just tough. You'd literally got nothing. And there were old cases from England and in this country, you know, in the earlier 1800s and going back, people like dying on the job, you know, because of the boss's fault. And the court's like, yeah, well, that's life. So what happened was workers started saying, like, this is no good, especially as you start getting more factories and it got more dangerous. And in some states, they started allowing these lawsuits. Right. So workers started to be able to go to court and sue if they could prove the employer was negligent and getting big damages. And then the bosses were like, right. So that was the compromise. Like, OK, we'll give you something. We're not going to leave you totally out in the cold. We'll cover your medical benefits and some of your lost income. But that's all you get. No pain and suffering, no punitive damages, you know, none of this other stuff. You know, you're not allowed to sue. And also, there's this whole process, workers' comp, you got to, you know, go through the independent medical exam, and, you know, you can be under surveillance to make sure that you're not, you know, out enjoying yourself playing tennis when you're supposed to have a broken foot or whatever. That was the point of the workers' comp compromise.
Yeah. So let me ask you a last question. I want to get into, you know, that.
I mean, to say he was warned never to put his hand inside the meat grinder, it's like, so what? I mean, that's really like missing the point. First of all, again, this kid was 17. It was illegal for him to be working on a meat grinder. So I don't care what you told him. Even if he was 47, I mean, I want everybody to be careful, and an adult who's working in a meat processing plant ought to be careful, and they should know enough not to put their hand inside a meat grinder. But just saying don't put your hand inside a meat grinder is not a substitute for having whatever reasonable safety precautions and training and everything else.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know what drove this kid. I don't know if the kid was just being dumb and stuck his hand in the meat grinder, or if it was like there was like a lot of pressure to keep going, and you know, someone told him to do this. You know, we don't really know what happened.
No, it's like I had a friend a number of years ago.
Just stick his hand in there.
No, I had a friend who reached into a snowblower because something got stuck in there, and you know, it was just one of those things. It's just right there again. He jammed a stick in, and he went to get the stick out, and it pulled his hand, and he chopped off two fingers. You go, dummy, you chopped off two fingers. But things happen.
People do these things, and it's again. Sometimes, you know, you're working with machinery and it jams, and you know, you're like, oh no, I gotta fix. You know, you don't necessarily think at 17. Again, this comes back to why we don't. Why the law doesn't allow 17-year-olds to work there, because 17-year-olds is even less likely to pause and think, no, I really shouldn't stick my hand in there. I should go get somebody, you know, who knows how to clean it out.
So final thought on what, you know, when you think of this, and what do we want people to know about this? Because this just seems like such a simple story, but there were so many wrong opinions on it. Any final thought?
Yeah, I think there's two things. I think one is people really need to wake up and pay attention to this movement to relax or undo child labor laws. I think it's really dangerous, but it's a very organized and well-funded, you know, campaign that's sweeping around the country. And people, you know, who see this, and if you think this is appalling, you need to act. You need to make sure, you know, at the state and federal level that these laws don't get weekend. The other thing is, you know, there's another law that's relevant here with, you know, potentially, which is OSHA, you know, federal law, and in some states, you know, managed by the state. So another thing that is not as effective as it needs to be, you know, there's not as much monitoring. So, you know, again, we don't know the whole story. It seems possible to me that there might have been some safety issue, you know, at play here, that made it, you know, that where the kid ended up sticking his hand. We need better OSHA enforcement. You know, the law in the books in some cases needs improvement, but even given the law, we need much better enforcement.
Yeah, well, I go back to, we need strong unions to ensure in the workplace this stuff doesn't happen. Just my thought. But Eric, as always,
that's the answer. I mean, that literally is the answer to all these things. Without that, it's not going to happen.
Nope, I'm right there. Appreciate the time, as always. Great stuff, my friend.
Thank you. Good to talk to you.
Thanks so much. Appreciate your expertise. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick at thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back to wrap things up. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1954. That was the day of the groundbreaking ceremony of what would come to be known as the greatest construction show on Earth. The show was the development of the St. Lawrence Seaway. The $1.2 billion project was a joint effort by Canada and the United States. It included the building of seven locks and widening of canals. The completed project would allow large cargo ships to travel all the way from the Atlantic Ocean to Duluth, Minnesota. It connected cities such as Chicago and Detroit to international trade routes to the east. The project also included the construction of a 3,216-foot-long hydroelectric dam. More than 22,000 engineers, carpenters, and laborers made the project possible. These workers dredged 360 million tons of materials and laid 6 million cubic yards of concrete. The massive construction project was finished in just 5 years. England's Queen Elizabeth II attended the opening ceremonies of the finished Seaway. Within the first 3 days, 168 vessels had traversed the new waterway. Jason Romano owned a trucking company that helped transport gravel to the project. He recalled, "The Seaway opened up the Great Lakes and brought ships to the heart of the country. And that is what makes this country great. The men who designed the project and worked with and under me are the unsung heroes." Jason's story, along with many other workers who made the project possible, were collected by Claire Parman in her book, The St. Lawrence Seaway and Power Project, an oral history of the greatest construction show on Earth. The book was released in 2009, commemorating 50 years since the completion of the massive project.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Show. Check out our website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. This is one of these interesting little Supreme Court things that I'm actually fairly happy with. Evidently, today the Supreme Court blocked a nationwide settlement with the Purdue Pharmaceutical Company, the maker of OxyContin or Cotin, that would shield the Sackler family, the people who own the company, from civil lawsuits over what happened with the opioids. The justices agreed with the Biden administration to put the brakes on this agreement. And because evidently last year, states and local governments, they came up with this settlement. And I don't know. I'm of the mindset you sue these people out of existence for the things that they did. Just completely, completely outrageous. I can't emphasize that enough. Just completely and totally outrageous what they got away with, and the number of people who died because of their marketing, their salesmanship. They're getting doctors to basically jam this stuff down people's throats. The reason that this is one of those personal things. I have a friend whose brother died. Because got hurt and then got hooked. I knew people I worked with, and I think of the one guy, you know, he broke his foot and messed up his neck and then got hooked. And, you know, it was then a series of bad things from there. As soon as the doctors start cutting it off, now you're searching for other stuff. Nothing positive here. And understand, I've had it offered to me for minor things. When I had my hip replaced, they wanted to jam it down my throat. And I'm like, I'm good. And it was a constant. It's the entire industry. So for me, there's a lot more culpability here than just the Sackler family, but they're front and forward. That simple. Got an email that I want to finish up with. Siding with me. And this is great. I love having people side with me. I don't usually side on the side of violence. But as I said earlier, this story from Pittsburgh of the guy with the dog, the French bulldog in the baby carriage that they left in the parking lot. I what do you do with someone like that? Now, some of the comments that I got, I probably can't and shouldn't repeat on air. I think your mind will go in the places where they probably should go. But it takes me back to, because one person said, you know, my opening was, you know, the cruelty of some people in our society, and, you know, the cruelty being the point and all of that. There's a connection there. You know, as they pointed out, there's a connection to the fact that whoever this person was, they didn't think twice about being cruel to this dog and could care less about what happened. It was all about them. And we've become this society. And look, I watched it happen. I remember, you know, the Reagan era, hooray for me and the heck with everyone else. The one with the most toys who dies and they win, you know, that kind of stuff. The question is, you know, good, decent, honest people, you, me, us, how do we change that? How do we hold people accountable? You know, we had a caller earlier said, look, you know, like when my grandfather, you know, told me, don't ever go across the street and play with that guy or his kids or grandkids or any of them, because he crossed the picket line, you know, 50 years beforehand, because society held people accountable. How do we do that again? How do we get to this moment where evil is checked? Not sure how we get there, other than, you know, being part of a community and coming together. I know. That sword cuts both ways. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Tomorrow on the big program, I'm going to spend a lot more time on the prevailing wage, because I think, again, this is transformative. The Biden administration, like I said,